This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. More than 800 are known to have died following Friday's earthquake and tsunami on central Indonesia's Sulawesi Island, one of the country's five largest. Rescuers fear the death toll could climb into the thousands as they try to reach communities cut off from communication. Dozens are believed trapped in the rubble of hotels and a shopping mall in the city of Palu, hit by waves as high as 6 meters following a 7.5 magnitude earthquake. Tom Howells is with the group Save the Children.
The airport has been closed in Palu for the last 2 days. It just reopened. There are other airports in the area. Once you get inland, then you've got further access problems. Get into the very epicenter. It's caused severe destruction to infrastructure, so it will be a major challenge. And then obviously in the coastal areas, the tsunami will have additional impacts.
Smaller aftershocks continue to rumble through the area. Several foreigners are among those missing. Questions are raised about the tsunami warning system set up in the wake of the 2004 tsunami that killed 230,000 and why it appeared to be ineffective. Peter McCauley is an Indonesian expert with the Australian National University.
It was not operating very well. Maintenance had not been sustained, and it seems that first incorrect signals were given, and when the incorrect signals were given, they were not transmitted to the local people. So in other words, the system broke down.
President Joko Widodo visited the devastated region Sunday. He has appealed for international help for disaster response and relief. Cameroon has imposed a 48-hour curfew on the English-speaking regions of the majority French-speaking country during the one-year anniversary of a symbolic independence declaration by separatists who proclaimed the Republic of Ambazonia. The anniversary comes a week ahead of presidential elections, in which 85-year-old incumbent Paul Biya is seeking a seventh term. The curfew is aimed at restricting the movement of peoples. This is VOA News. Macedonians voting in a referendum on changing the Balkan country's name did not turn out in sufficient numbers to make it legally valid, a setback for Prime Minister Zoran Zaev and his bid to join NATO and the European Union. The Prime Minister told supporters he'll press on with a vote in Parliament, insisting there can be no better agreement with Greece. He called for putting the country's interests ahead of political and party interests. Although over 90% of those casting ballots supported the change to the Republic of Northern Macedonia, only 34% of eligible voters cast ballots. The referendum was a result of an agreement reached with Greece in June to change the name, so Greece will drop its opposition to the former Yugoslav Republic's bid to join NATO and the EU. Three school-age boys were killed Sunday in eastern Ukraine when they triggered a mine. A fourth boy was wounded. The explosion occurred in the industrial city of Horlivka, north of the rebel de facto capital Donetsk. Fighting broke out in 2014 between Russian-backed separatists and the Kyiv government. The U.S. and Canada beat a midnight deadline, reaching an agreement to update the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. The compromise reportedly includes boosting U.S. access to Canada's dairy market while protecting Canada from potential U.S. auto tariffs. The deadline had to do with a mandatory 60-day review period before Congress acts on the deal. Agreement was reached in late August on a separate pact with Mexico, the other NATO partner. A powerful typhoon is moving across Japan, forcing cancellation of flights and trains, injuring dozens, and causing mass evacuations and widespread flooding. Typhoon Trami lost some strength after making landfall southwest of Tokyo. It was a month ago that Japan felt the wrath of Typhoon Jebi, considered the most powerful in 25 years. The highest court in the Maldives has granted former President Mahmoud Abdul Gayoom bail Sunday, the latest jailed opponent of President Abdullah Yameen, to gain his freedom since the incumbent lost a re-election bid last week to opposition lawmaker Ibrahim Mohamed Saleh. A U.S. Navy destroyer sailed near the contested islands in the South China Sea claimed by Beijing Sunday. A U.S. official said the Decatur traveled within 12 nautical miles of Gavin and Johnson Reefs in the Spratly Islands. China's claims to the islands are being challenged by Brunei, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Denny Tamaki, who campaigned against the U.S. military presence, won the governorship of Okinawa, defeating the candidate backed by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Okinawa is home to about half the 54,000 American military personnel stationed in Japan. Tamaki is the son of a U.S. Marine and Japanese mother. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Botte in Washington. Today is Monday, the first day of October, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. First Lady Melania Trump is expected to arrive in Ghana today, Monday.
Ghanaians are very hospitable people. Our First Lady is an example of our hospitality, and we expect to accord the U.S. First Lady the level of hospitality that would accord a person befitting her status.
Kojo Opon Nkrumah is Ghana's Deputy Information Minister. Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio explains his corruption-fighting message to the diaspora. Today is Nigeria's 58th independence anniversary, and the DRC ruling coalition says Saturday's opposition rally was a failure.
They didn't give the name of the candidate, and they didn't give the master PowerPoint. So I think this rally showed that the opposition leaders are not ready.
Andre Alain Atundu is spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition. And Zimbabwe's health minister says his country is winning the battle against the cholera outbreak. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. First Lady Melania Trump is expected to arrive in Ghana today, Monday, on the first stop of her four-nation Africa tour. She will later go on to Malawi, Kenya, and Egypt. Mrs. Trump's trip is expected to focus on maternal and newborn care in hospitals. Ghana's Deputy Information Minister Kojo Opon Nkrumah says Mrs. Trump's Be Best program fits in well with Ghanaian First Lady Rebecca Akufo-Addo's own program of promoting child welfare. Nkrumah says Ghanaians are usually hospitable people and will give the U.S. First Lady the level of hospitality befitting of her status.
She's arriving in Ghana as part of an African tour, and in Ghana, her principal focus is child development as part of her Be Best program. And it ties in very well with a program by Ghana's First Lady, Rebecca Akufo-Addo, which is focused on improving maternal health care for mothers and children in Ghana. It's our expectation that the two first ladies would find points of collaboration between their two programs so that collectively we can work towards improving the lot of mothers and children the world over.
So, Mr. Minister, tell us, what do you think Ghana was chosen as the first stop?
I think it's because of the evidence of the progress that Ghana has made and is making in the area of child development and welfare and in maternal health care, as I mentioned earlier. And the results of our work suggest that the little efforts with the little resources that have been made and the kind of leadership that is being shown is bearing fruit. And that's why Mrs. Trump would want to associate with it.
Your president, Nana Akufo-Addo, was here at the just-concluded United Nations General Assembly. How would you describe U.S.-Ghanaian relations?
Ghana has always been a pace setter in many matters, including the geopolitics that include Ghana or African-American relationships. And I think the kind of example that Ghana's president, President Akufo-Addo, is setting with his Ghana Beyond Aid agenda and with his economic recovery program, as well as his social development program, are points of example or reflection for the rest of the world, including America. And that's why I would imagine that even after his speeches and his performance in the U.S., Mrs. Trump would want to come to Ghana and associate with what we are doing here.
I know these are two first ladies, and they may have nothing to do with the policies, but here some immigrants are concerned about the current administration's immigration policy, and now the First Lady of Ghana is meeting the First Lady of the United States. Do you think that might likely come up?
Ghana has always been frontal in terms of our views on international relations and indeed our views on immigration. We believe that the answer is in ensuring that we have excellent economic opportunities back home for our people so that less of them have to migrate to other shores. However, for those who have to migrate, we believe that the utmost level of respect needs to be accorded them in all matters. It's a position we have held in times past, and it's a position we intend to hold on to.
What sort of reception do you think awaits the U.S. First Lady?
Ghanaians are very hospitable people. Our First Lady is an example of our hospitality, and we expect to accord the U.S. First Lady the level of hospitality that would accord a person befitting her status. But our expectation is that this visit translates into a deepened relationship for our bilateral exercise as well as our tourism potential.
Thank you very much, Mr. Minister. It's always nice to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kojo Obong Nkrumah is Ghana's Deputy Information Minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Accra. Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio over the weekend outlined his vision for the country, including the fight against corruption, when he spoke to the diaspora during a town hall meeting in Washington, D.C. He also underscored his administration's strategy to attract foreign investment, create jobs, and reduce his country's high unemployment rate. Sierra Leonean Information Minister Mohamed Suare told VOA's Peter Clotty that President Bio successfully entered the U.S. despite charges or claims by critics that he had violated immigration laws when he lived here in the U.S. as a student.
Remember, many back home had said President Bio will not be issued a visa. He will not come to the U.S. So this was a very triumphant entry into the U.S. with special security guards and all of that. I mean, the citizens of Sierra Leone were very pleased that the man they have been craving for to see all these years was finally here and in grand style.
I understand before he held the town hall meeting, he'd met some investors both in New York and Washington, D.C., trying to ginger up and attract direct foreign investors to Sierra Leone. How did it go and what did he speak about, particularly to attract these investors to Sierra Leone?
Well, President Bio is keen to ensure that we promote trade rather than aid dependence. So in all of the engagements he's had, he has not lost a moment to brandish Sierra Leone's huge potentials in trade and investment. He has touted our country's rich potentials in minerals, in human resources, and all-year beautiful weather. He's also added that with the new dawn, the fight against corruption should make our country an enduring investment destination. So that is what he's been saying, and many seem very convinced by that. In New York, we addressed a large suite of investors at an investment conference organized by a Sierra Leonean group. He laid bare and clear the opportunities for investment in Sierra Leone, where investors and Sierra Leone can share profits on a win-win basis, and where profits could be repatriated without any encumbrances. At the same forum was the NGC leader, Dr. Kande Kole-Yomkela, the C4C leader. So President Bio is ensuring that he's taking everybody along on the journey to a bright new future for our country.
An instance was spoken about by the president where some investors said they were confronted with corruption right at certain point in time with their plans of coming to Sierra Leone to invest. How is he going to address the challenges of corruption in and outside Sierra Leone?
President Bio already has at hand a very determined young man who is very busy at the moment fighting corruption. He is leaving no stone unturned. At the same time, you are also aware that we have plans to set up commissions of inquiry. We're in advanced stages of doing that. We're bringing together some of the region's best judges to work alongside our judiciary to ensure that we address the issues of impunity, issues of graft and corruption. These are the challenges that have bedeviled the private sector over the years. We want to make sure we address its roots and shoots so that potential investors have nothing to fear and there is strong political will to ensure that we match our every word to fight corruption and to make our country an attractive investment destination.
How does he plan to attract Sierra Leoneans in the diaspora to come and help with their expertise, with their knowledge, with things they've learned here and elsewhere to contribute to the vision of what he plans to do for the people of Sierra Leone?
At the various town hall meetings President Bio have addressed, he has called on Sierra Leoneans abroad to return home to join the country in our national development aspirations.
Mohamed Suare is Sierra Leone's Information Minister. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, the first day of October. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. Nigeria is today, October 1st, commemorating 58 years of independence from Britain. With Boko Haram and ethnic agitations on the rise, some commentators are questioning whether the colonially enforced Federal Union has been a failure or a success. This year's celebration is also coming just 5 months before the country's 2019 presidential election. President Muhammadu Buhari, speaking at a pre-Independence Day event on Friday, called on Nigerians to see their diversity as a source of strength. Femi Adesina, special advisor on media and publicity to Mr. Buhari, says the president will address the nation this morning, touting his administration's successes and the way forward.
A broadcast is coming, which will be on air from 7 a.m. this morning, October 1. The president is going to give some account of his stewardship to the country, and he will also talk about the election next year and some other things going forward.
You mentioned the election next year. Would the president say that everything is stable politically in the country?
As far as we can see, things are stable because all the things happening do not in any way translate to political instability. I think everything happening is just right down the alley of politicking. When you have politicking with high stakes like the presidency of a country, all the things we see now are not unnatural. They do happen.
Again, I mentioned people defecting, leaving your party, the ruling APC. The Minister for Women's Affairs, Aisha Al-Hassan, is the latest person to resign. The president has accepted the resignation. Could you tell us more?
Well, it's within her even constitutional right to leave any party and join another. You know, she has since joined another political party and may be running as governor on the platform of that party. But the reason for leaving is what you must consider. She was screened and found not qualified by the party standards to be a flag bearer. So she was not cleared, and thereafter she felt, well, if she couldn't be a member of the party, she shouldn't also be a minister. So she resigned from the cabinet and from the party, and she has since joined another political party. The president has accepted a letter of resignation and wished her well.
As you mentioned, the elections are coming next year. The opposition is using the government that it has not done much for the people and is using that as a platform against the ruling party.
Well, since you call them opposition, what should they do? They should oppose. But you see, when you play opposition politics, you don't have to oppose blindly. But at times we see blind opposition in Nigeria in that there are some things that are so practically evident that they choose not to see them. So when it is like that, it is not opposition that is useful or not opposition that is credible.
President Buhari spoke to the just concluded United Nations General Assembly in New York. What do you think was the highlight? Because as the election is coming, the opposition is saying that the government has failed in its fight against Boko Haram.
It is the opposition that says it's nothing to worry about. Because the people truly know, those who live in the northeast part of the country particularly, who have borne the brunt of their insurgency since it began in 1989, will tell you the difference they have seen between 2015 and now.
It's so nice to talk with you, and let me say happy Independence Day to you on October 1st.
Thank you.
Femi Adesina is special advisor on media and publicity to President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria. You are speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. A spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition says Saturday's opposition rally was a failure to opposition supporters because their leaders failed to choose a single candidate for the coming December 23rd presidential election. Andre Alain Atundu also says the rally was a disappointment because of the opposition failed to reveal its platform. During Saturday's rally, opposition leaders, including Felix Tshisekedi, complained about the introduction of voting machines, which they said are vulnerable to vote rigging and could be compromised by DRC's unreliable power supply. But Atundu says the issue of voting machines' unreliability should be the concern of all candidates.
In my opinion, the rally was a big miss and a real failure because all the leaders, you notice, were there, but they hardly could bring about less than 10,000 of people. Suddenly, the expectations of people was about the name of the unique candidate for the opposition and the master PowerPoint of the program. They didn't give the name of the candidates, and they didn't give the master PowerPoints. Instead of this, they just disconcert the people by this issue of voting machine and fingerprinting. So I think this rally show that the opposition leaders are not ready to give way to one of them to represent them. Secondly, they are not prepared for elections. They hope that the elections will be delayed.
The argument they are making is that the voting machines are cheating machines. They are not reliable. They are too slow. And there are 10 million fake voters who have already been registered. Fake voters.
This is a technical issue. It depends on SENI. If the machine is so far, so late for the vote, they should prepare anyway the election. If the machine is not able to take enough people for the vote, it's for them, it's for us too. So I don't understand why they make this point their own point. That's points for all the political class.
Mr. Felix Tshisekedi, one of the candidates, said at the rally that the opposition will remain united. And you are saying they are not united and they are not ready for election.
If they are ready to be united, they should reveal the name of one of them who will be their representative to run the presidential election. They should give the main power point of their program. And instead of this, I repeat, they choose the easy way to disconcert the people.
One of the arguments they are making is that because you fear the opposition, President Kabila or the Elections Commission, they not allow Katumbi and Jean-Pierre Bemba to stand.
This is legal conditions. In the United States of America, if you are not born in the States, you can't be a candidate to run presidential election. Here, if you were condemned for corruption, you cannot. If you were condemned, as Mr. Katumbi is, you cannot. This is a legal condition for everyone.
Andre Alain Otundu, a spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition, is speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Zimbabwe's health minister says his country is winning the battle against the cholera outbreak, which has so far killed 49 people since it broke out early September. But the minister says Zimbabwe needs millions of dollars more from the international community to deal with the waterborne disease, which has since spread to other parts of the country from its epicenter of the capital, Harare. Columbus Mavunga reports from New York City.
In an interview over the weekend, Zimbabwe's health minister, Dr. Obadiah Moyo, said the government is winning the battle against the cholera outbreak, which has since spread to most parts of the country. He said the country has been recording less cases compared to early September, when the waterborne disease hit some densely populated areas in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
Well, we're moving in the right direction. You know, we look at what's called the epic curve, which shows us in which direction we are going. And initially, we had a peak of the cases arriving, suspected cases. And then with the interventions that came in, that we put in place, there was a flattening of the curve, you know, and the interventions further caused a total reduction to close to zero.
Experts say Harare has to up its hygiene game by improving clean water supply and sanitation, as well as increasing trash collection. To accomplish that goal, President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government has made an international appeal for assistance. Finance Minister Professor Muthuli Ncube explains how the response has been.
Our government has donated just over $15 million of its own money into the cholera fight. Corporates have chipped in as well. Now we're well over $30 million in terms of donations in both cash and kind. Now, the total envelope we need is of the order of $64 million.
That was Colombo Mavunga reporting from New York City. Time now for Daybreak Africa. I suppose here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with preparations ahead of the 2019 CAF African Cup of Nations, where the Confederation of African Football, CAF, says it will give the final decision over Cameroon as host of the 2019 Total African Cup of Nations, AFCON, in November 2018. The CAF Executive Committee meeting held this past weekend in Egypt reached a decision that the final decision will be taken after the last inspection vision programmed in November. In the meantime, the Confederation of African Football President Ahmed Ahmed on Sunday said CAF will support FIFA President Gianni Infantino in his re-election bid next year. CAF officially endorsed the candidacy of Infantino at its Congress in Egypt on Sunday, but an official endorsement has previously proven no guarantee of votes, with many African associations breaking ranks in past elections. Murtada Mansour, chairman of Egyptian giant Zamalek, has been banned from all football-related activity for a year by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, following comments he made about leading CAF officials. African football's governing body issued the punishment after Mansour was seen in a video allegedly insulting CAF President Ahmed Ahmed and General Secretary Amir Fahmy. 66-year-old Mansour has also been issued with a fine of $40,000. Gor Mahia were on Sunday crowned the 2018 Kenya Premier League champions for the fourth time in 5 years and their record 17th title after their match against Mathare United at the Moi Stadium in Kisumu. Prior to the coronation, the defending champions were held to a 2-2 draw by hard-fighting Mathare United at the same venue in the penultimate match of the 2018 season. Dylan Kerr is head coach of Gor Mahia.
The game ended poorly for us, and fair play to Mathare. They came and gave it a go, but, you know, today's about the fans, you know, so I just want the fans to enjoy it. I want them to recognise the players and the hard work, because it's been hard work what we've done this year.
In basketball news, Nigeria women basketball team, the Tigress, lost 73-72 to Canada as they finished 8th in the last classification playoff game of the 2018 FIBA Women's Basketball World Cup played on Sunday to determine the sides who finished 5th to 8th after their quarterfinal knockout to the United States of America. Despite the loss, Coach Otis Hogley believes that the girls have the potentials to be world champions.
I guarantee you, we may not shoot the ball as well. If we did, then no one would beat us. But it takes a lot of intelligence to beat a team and never make a jump shot. And people from our hemisphere and our country of Nigeria and the continent of Africa are the most intelligent people on the face of the earth.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, October 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very productive week.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, can Africa win the war on corruption? the African Union has declared 2018 the African Year of Anti-Corruption, charting a battle plan to win the fight against corruption on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.